Good morning, honourable members. Good morning, HSRC. Today, honourable members, HSRC is giving a presentation to us on very important matters that affect tourism. In the research they have done, studies that are tourism related, and we'll be giving us some presentation today. But before we do anything else, I am this Ngobo, and chairing this committee. Actually, it's the first time I see HSRC in a department that does not have science in particular and health relations. I see HSRC when I was with, in the DST committee, the health committee, and seeing you for the first time in tourism. Maybe we all wanted to know around the research that you've been doing, because we've been reading things on our machines or machinery about the work that is done by HSRC. I am the president of the committee. On my right is Dr. Sibusiso Kuzwayo, who is the content advisor for this committee. On my left is the secretary of the committee, who sent a letter of invitation to you, Jerry Poltina, and the other members will introduce themselves. Honorable Adams, starting with you.
Good morning.
And everybody will introduce themselves. Thank you, Adam.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Patricia Adams, and I'm a member of the committee deployed here by the ANC. Thank you.
Morning, Chairperson, and members from the HRC. Mr. Okulu, member of the committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Greg Kumbach. I represent the province of KwaZulu-Natal, and I'm one of the Democratic Alliance members of the committee. Chairperson, I'm current South Holly Court. Holly Court.
Because this is more
of an information gathering meeting. We are going to take the presentation. Whatever travel is coming.
So I think we won't be there bad.
Thanks.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Pietro Sanita. I'm the Parliamentary Liaison Officer in the Office of the Director General of Tourism.
Good morning, honourable members and chairperson and colleagues. My name is Myron Peters. I'm from the National Department of Tourism. I work in the domestic branch, working with about 4 or 5 provinces. I've been asked to attend and all that place.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Pumkin Tui. I'm the researcher for the committee.
Good morning, everybody. It's Ma Hussain from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning, everybody. I'm currently the assistant of the committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Nancy Peterson. I'm the secretary of the committee.
I'm Edward Bobby, I'm a journalist with HSRC.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. My name is John Gando, I'm the chief researcher at HSRC in the Economic Performance and Development Unit.
Good morning, my name is Emma Williams. I'm also a research partner in Economic Performance and Development, and I'm a senior researcher.
Good morning, my name is Kit Asmo. I'm a researcher from HSRC in the same department as well.
Thank you very much. Tourism is also part of the economic cluster here in Parliament, so I think we are participated to get information from you. And honourable members, it is quite important that we understand the research trends which HSRC will be giving to us today. And this will also help the members to be empowered in oversight. the work of the research will help improve our oversight when we are doing site work, and to understand the work that is done by the HSRC and in the years by, maybe in the years coming, we will be getting some information from our net. And then I have also seen in their brief that they've managed to align business development to tourism. So this will help us to understand where tourism fits to the national development plan. And also maybe they will give us some recommendations on specific, on some aspects. For instance, if there is anything they can say to us about rural tourism and, you know, each program, and share with us time permitting best practice around tourism, SMEs. We are a developing country, and we can give some examples of what is happening in other developing countries. May I hand over to you, Sir? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think firstly what we've...
Sorry, before you start, I'm sorry, I'm very sorry. Really, can I have apologies?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, we have three apologies. Honourable Mahela, Honourable Trevor will be joining us later, Chair, and Honourable those are the apologies that we have. Thank you.
Honourable, they were fell sick this morning, so he's not able to come because he's a doctor. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. One of the things that we would also like to say up front is that the work that we're going to present today basically forms most of the research that HSRC has done around tourism. And one of the things that we've done is circulate almost like a bibliography that contains all of the studies that we have. So what we've done for this presentation is to try and align some of the work that we've done with the NDP. And we've chosen a few studies that basically illustrate some of the core findings that are coming out from our work that have reference for the NDP. So that's basically the overview of the presentation. So the first section that we're going to present to you is largely beginning the process of mapping specific chapters that have a direct relevance to the NDP. And this will basically serve as a way of also contextualizing the relevance of HSRC's work with respect to the NDP. So one of the things that we did was we went through the NDP and identified those chapters. So there are basically five chapters that directly are relevant, reference to tourism. And I think it's chapters 3, 4, 6, and 7, and 9. But you tend to notice that the role of tourism within the National Development Plan is mostly situated in chapter 3, economy and employment, and chapter 6, inclusive rural development. So basically, we're just going to work through some of the specific references that we have. So basically, I think the story in chapter 1 is related to employment and poverty reduction. And there, I think chapter 3 recognizes that tourism can contribute to employment and growth. But more importantly, for you to be able to do that, certain conditions have to be met, such as increase in tourism spending, increase in the number of tourists that are entering the country, and also leveraging visitors from worldwide by air, because these are seen as having relatively large multipliers. There's also a focus in the NDP on trade in services. And again, here, tourism is seen as one of the fastest growing global sectors, and that South Africa can have the potential to compete in. But however, this is going to require strengthening skills. And with respect to that, it has implications on the tourism human resource development strategy. And that's situated in Chapter 10. Chapter 4 is basically economic infrastructure, and I think the key issue in Chapter 4 are related to infrastructure with respect to water and its relevance to tourism.
And there's also the role of transport in infrastructure, specifically related to the ability of transport in the future to move large volumes of passengers and arrivals, and also the need to mitigate some of the negative impacts that can arise from prohibitive costs with respect to transport, and even largely related to South Africa's geographical location in the globe. So chapter 6 includes the world economy, and here again, I think tourism is basically seen as stimulating areas of local economies in rural areas, and it highlights the importance of involving local communities so as to realize the potential of tourism in rural economies. And one of the things that tourism amongst other sectors is expected to basically raise the level of economic participation in rural areas from about 29% to 40%. Chapter 7 is positioning South Africa and the rest of the world. So there is recognition in the NDP that South Africa can actually benefit from greater regional integration and great. Some of the benefits that arise from greater regional integration are related to the provision of access both regionally and internationally with respect to tourism. Chapter 8 is related to transformation and human settlement, and I think here the main thrust of Chapter 8 is looking at the material conditions that are found in rural areas with respect to poverty and a whole range of social ills, mainly rural areas and inherent townships. So one of the observations is that you tend to notice that some of these challenges, especially in the former homeland, that are related to unemployment, are also coexist in areas where there are tourism assets. So then there is now a question of trying to leverage tourism and connect those communities to tourism value chains. But there's also a view that if these issues are not resolved, then there might be conflicts that arise, specifically conflicts around resources that might actually have an impact on tourism. So by and large, this underscores the role of tourism in stimulating, especially areas that have experienced a decline in traditional industries, such as agriculture and mining, areas which have high unemployment rates. So essentially speaking, this is almost the full NDP. And you tend to notice that of the 15 chapters that are in the NDP, 5 of them are got a specific reference to tourism, and that's chapter 3, 4, 6, 7, and 8. And then there are other chapters that also have relevant tourism, but tourism is not explicitly mentioned in those chapters, and that's transitioning to a low carbon economy. And there that's issues around carbon emissions and the extent to which they might affect the attitudes of people, mainly in the Western world, to travel. As they try and reduce their carbon footprint, and also issues around ecotourism are found in chapter 5. Improving education and innovation, I think this broadly references the need to enhance South Africa's human development, human resource development, and again, if that is relevant with respect to the tourism human resource development strategy. And then the other chapters that have somewhat of an indirect link to tourism. Social protection, I think this is related to employment with respect to the labor intensity of tourism and its employment creation. So the idea there is an increase in employment reduces the dependency on the country's social protection system. And also building safer communities, and here I think it speaks about crime and the impact of crime with respect to the perception of visitors and the willingness of visitors to come to South Africa. So by and large, this is where tourism is situated within the NDP and some of the factors where it has an indirect link to. So the work that we have done is the HSRC, together with some of the people in our units, in the various units within the HSRC, can be broadly clustered around 5 thematic areas, economy and employment. And I think the chair alluded to the fact that most of the presentations that have been done have been in the sciences. But I think us as the economic performance and development unit, one of our major focuses is also issues around the economy and employment, transforming urban and rural spaces, low carbon and green economy, skills training, education, and social and cultural issues. And all of these broad thematic areas have got a relevance for tourism.
So our work has also, largely the main thrust of the work is responding to the so-called triple challenge of poverty, inequality and unemployment. And I think the tourism is seen as playing a substantial role with respect to addressing some of those challenges. So broadly our work definitely does map onto those chapters that have been identified in the NPP. Also work around transformation of rural and urban spaces. There's been work that we've done around that, which is going to be chapter 6. Pro-poor tourism and local economic development, because some of the projects around rural development, responsible township tourism, which is relevant to chapter 8. Tourism and the second economy, relevant to chapter 3. And some of these we will have specific studies that we have done that we're going to present today. There's work on social and cultural issues, which reflects a particular research niche in the HSRC in the field of human and social sciences, and there's a small body of work on law government education and training. So now I'll hand over to my colleague Emma.
Organizing myself. I will talk about the focus areas that we have outlined and the HSRC research which speaks to that. And at some point I will hand over to Stuart again. And as mentioned, we see that both of our work actually is focused on the economy and employment. And here we've looked at the role of services for growth and employment in South Africa. And when we talk about services, we realize that tourism is part of that. And tourism is identified as a growth sector in a number of provincial economies, and then our work is often focused around doing specific studies for provinces on the tourism sector in that region. And we've also looked at the importance of innovation for competitiveness, not only for the competitiveness of tourism firms, but also of destinations and regions, and I will say a little bit more about that later on. Our work included analyses of visitor arrivals as well as visiting friends and relatives tourism. There is a body of work that looks at tourism as an avenue for local economic development, and here it's in urban spaces as well as in small towns and rural areas. We've also specifically looked at tourism as an avenue for pro-poor development. Been social economic impact studies of lens and festivals. We've looked at the role of tourism SMEs and tourism second economy. Two studies that I will just talk a little bit, is at the bottom of that slide. So firstly, there was a study looking at tourism innovation in the Western Cape. And the basic premise is that that innovation enhances long-term competitiveness. And this is what we get out of economic theory. And then you see that services, including tourism, have exhibited strong economic growth in Western Cape. I haven't included the figures here, but up to 73% of the provincial GDP comes from service sectors. I mean, tourism is part of that. I mean, when we do analyses of the economic figures, we see that most of the growth over the last two decades, and most of the employment creation has also been within service sectors. We've unfortunately, particularly in the Cape Town area, have seen a decline in certain manufacturing activities around clothing industry and agro-processing from the fisheries. And it's a similar picture in South Africa, so the contribution of services to the provincial economy is 73%, but if you look at the whole picture in South Africa, 69% of the South African GDP is contributed by service sectors. And then we ask them the question, so if this is the case, why are services excluded from innovation policy support in South Africa, which is mostly in the field of science and technology, very techno-specific and very technological focused. But a large part of our economy is actually services, where we fund non-technological kinds of innovation. So this research study surveyed innovation activities by tourism firms, throughout the Western Cape and also looked at the various subsectors of tourism, for example, accommodation, transport, restaurants, hospitality, and other activities, leisure activities. So the finding, one of the main findings is that up to 60% of tourism enterprises can be considered as innovative. And this is very much in line with the National Innovation Survey's finding that the percentage for innovation in service firms is very similar to what we found. But the vast majority of innovation is incremental. And what this means is that firms have not necessarily introduced new or novel innovation, but rather improvements, significant improvements according to the methodology that we use to define innovation. And we've also seen that most tourism innovations are non-technological, and that is similar in other service sectors. The accommodation sector is the most innovative, financial constraints is a key barrier, and this is also not surprising because when we do innovation studies in other sectors, this often comes up. And then networking for innovation is weak overall in the tourism sector. And then some recommendations are that there needs to be support for innovation by tourism firms, and here we are highlighting financial support, but that is not the only kind of support that we recommend. Then there needs to stimulate innovation networks in the tourism industry and overall to strengthen relationships between government, researchers and industry. So this is very much in line with literature in regard to innovation networking and innovation systems, because those identify or those systemic relationships in the tourism industry. It's not there, at least not in the Western Cape. Then we've looked at the tourism potential in Limpopo. Particular objectives included the composition of the tourism industry in the province, and then also the contribution of tourism, the types of activities and packages, what are factors hindering tourism diversification and other barriers. Key findings is that the tourism sector contributes up to 5% of the province's GDP, and despite efforts by the provincial government, the majority of respondents felt that the policies that they've implemented in terms of tourism is not very effective. And then there's also a need for incentives and marketing strategies to be improved, because often these things are not known even though they are in existence. So there needs to be more awareness about the potential policies and incentives, improve communication and also improve value chain in the tourism, in specific clusters in the tourism sector. Then a cross-cutting area is the area of urban and rural spaces. And a lot of this actually talks to the economic and employment issues, like we've mentioned before. Some work that we've done includes the role of tourism and creative industries, and this is particularly within urban areas, so places like Hamburg and Cape Town and Durban, where there is creative industries like the film industry and the fashion industry and publishing and so on. Those are the things that we talk about when we talk about creative industries, which is different from the cultural industries, which is more craft and performance art. Then tourism certainly has a role in urban regeneration, again we're seeing this in the cities, but we've also done work on rural development, and when we talk about the role of tourism in rural development, the focus is often on nature-based and ecotourism, and then there's been a number of studies that look into that in a little bit more detail. Also highlighting the importance of community participation in rural tourism ventures. Two case studies that I'll talk about is responsible tourism in townships, and then also ecotourism in Amazizi. So we are arguing that tourism has a potential role for less township areas. When we talk about township tourism, there are people that have different approaches to studying this, but most people in South Africa say we have to look at the potential of tourism in this area to actually make a difference. and create some employment in township areas. This particular study looked at visitor demand in the West, but also considered the stakeholder perspective in relation to township tourism. So there is a perceived demand by visitors, but we found that tourism product offering is underdeveloped. So there is very little that has been done to develop what is on offer in terms of tourism in township areas. And this is not only the case in Soweto, we find this in other township areas as well. So people come and then there's often not a lot to see and do, and those things to see and do present opportunities for locals to actually offer something. Locals are positive, at least in this case they were. I've read other studies in South Africa where they say locals are not necessarily positive, but we found that they were positive about tourism in the area, but they do not really benefit from it, which is something that we need to look at because this is an area of policy intervention. And we do have in that study made recommendations for fostering responsible tourism. And what this means is that there need to be more opportunities for local people to be employed, to showcase a certain cultural heritage aspects, to procure from local areas and so on. So there's a number of recommendations in that regard. Then ecotourism in Azizi, this is in the southern Drakensberg area. Here we also look at employment opportunities in tourism for people from the local community, and there were 174 households interviewed. And we found that there is very limited participation by locals in the tourism industry of the area other than being labourers. Self-employment and entrepreneurship in the local tourism sector is very limited for people from this community. And the land tenure system is a problem, the cause of leakage, and the recommendations include that the area can be opened up to other land users. Locals can supply produce to the local tourism sector, and innovation and diversification is needed to sustain livelihoods and alleviate poverty. Then another area is the low carbon or green economy. As we said, there's been a very small body of research from us in this regard. And there has been some studies on human needs and the environment, energy saving in hotels, and then the green economy study in Limpopo, which I will be saying a little bit more about. So definitely recognizing that there is a need to balance transition to a green economy with the poverty alleviation and job creation objectives that we've got as part of our developmental agenda. Then what the research questions or objectives included was to actually identify economic activities in the province in the green economy. So current, emerging and planned green economic activities were identified. And then lessons and challenges with that, with regards to impact, expected and realized impact. And then the project informs the future design and support of green initiatives in the province. When I went through this in preparation, it's interesting to see the kinds of things that come up here, because we are from the HSRC, which you will perhaps not hear elsewhere. So this is a niche. We are mostly doing work in human and social sciences. And one of the studies looked at the born-free generation and heritage tourism, but also then sex tourism and expectation, the issue of gender, age, orphan tourism, and also attitudes and sexual behavior amongst tourism workers. And you will see the HSLC flavor here. And I know that they have been big studies on human trafficking. It's been a huge focus of work at the HSRC, and this is where the sex tourism and exploitation comes in. A very tricky study to do as well. It's not been done by us, but other colleagues at the HSRC, so unfortunately I can't say much about that, but I will talk on a selective studies outlined at the bottom of the slide. Okay. So there are a number of sites that have been identified as places of historical and cultural importance. We've got national provincial heritage sites, and it was identified that there's a need for young people to visit these sites. What we've done is we had a survey called the South African Social Attitude Survey, and we've included questions in the survey on heritage sites and the public attitudes towards these, particularly with a focus on young people, the born, so-called born-free generation. And we found that the young people are interested in the nation's history and heritage, but in many cases they've not heard about or not aware about the various sites that we have. And we've also identified that heritage tourism can contribute to economic growth and create a sense of national cohesion, but more needs to be done to get young people to actually visit these sites. And such sites need to be promoted to young people. I think I'm handing over to Stuart again.
So we've also done work on the impact of festivals on local economies, and I think here the main thrust of it is related to the need to induce economic activity in some of these rural areas. And I think the motivation lies, as I alluded to earlier on, from the fact that there has been a decline in traditional industries. The advantage of tourism is that you can actually have a fairly large dispersion with respect to occurrence of tourism assets across the country. So definitely there are opportunities for some of these rural economies to benefit from tourism. So basically the study that I'm going to talk to, one of its objectives was to measure the magnitude of the impact from the cultural event. To estimate the impact, and specifically to estimate the impact of the 2014 Maruna Festival, from given estimates of the direct, of the indirect, and induced economic impacts of the festival, and also to look at things like the demographic composition of the festival, and to assess the expenditure distribution of people attending the festival. So the main finding there was, on average, 66% of the businesses reported a positive impact with respect to the festival, and about 35% reported no impact or a slight decrease in their business. Employment impact was not large, as we would expect, but around 20% of the respondents with respect to the with respect to the smart survey that we had of retailers, supermarkets, and so forth, showed that they'd actually hired additional people, and these were actually concentrated in the food and beverages industries, so these are your restaurants, your take-ups, and so forth. But one of the things that's also interesting about this intervention is that you tend to have quite a lot of cultural events in South Africa, and some of these are actually concentrated in the same province, so you could have about four or five of these happening. So with respect to the employment impact, I think the most important thing, given the nature of festivals, which are usually short-term, is basically the cumulative impact that would create some significant impact. There were 75% of the respondents on average were from the province, whilst 12% were from Gauteng. And the significance of this with respect to the ability of events to stimulate local economies is that the injection of new expenditure from outside the local economy is what actually drives the size of the economic impact. And in some cases, people like the literature actually says once you have repeat visitors to an event, the expenditures of those visitors doesn't really contribute, because it's almost as if that money is guaranteed, or the expenditure becomes guaranteed within the local economy. So it doesn't have the potential of stimulating a new demand within that economy. 23% of the attendees, so this is a week-long festival, so 23% of the people who attended stayed for 2 nights, and I think the average was about 3 nights. And the importance of that also is the size of the impact is also mediated by the duration of stay, the longer people, the longer they stay, the greater the impact. And I'm going to speak, about that later on. So with respect to income, the total direct visitor expenditure, we estimated that to be at about 25 million. And the total organizer expenditure was about 2.7 million. One of the things that we also noticed, and this is something that's relatively common in small local economies, is the fact that the leakage, the average stock leakage ratio tends to be relatively high. So this is basically arising from the fact that when businesses within these localities replenish their stock, they usually bring their stock from outside the local economy. So we did a ratio of about 67%. We ended up with a basic multiplier of about 1.49. And that would then give a total economic impact for the festival at about 42 million rand. So what we did to try and contextualize this was to look at it from the perspective of the local economy, monthly gross regional domestic product. So basically, we estimate that it possibly contributed about 4% to the local economy's gross regional product. So the recommendations are that the leakage, the duration of visitor stay, these are important. The number of non-local visitors are important in determining the size of the multiplier. And then with respect to the leakage, there has to be a shift, or incentives have to be made with respect to procurement, and procurement should basically be incentivized or targeted towards local businesses. So one of the things that we did was to categorize some of these businesses according to their leakage ratios, and there were some businesses that had relatively significantly high leakage ratio of about 90 to 100%. So most of that money simply flows through the program. So these were your typical sectors such as your pharmaceuticals, your liquor, your beverage industries, and that's simply arising from the fact that the production of these commodities is relatively centralized. But there were certain sectors, especially hospitality and restaurants, who have showed the potential of reducing the leakage ratio, and this was measured by the fact that with your pharmaceuticals, you tend to not consume them, tend to be skewed towards the higher end. But when you look at things like hospitality, if you look at where they were sourcing the inputs, you have about 25%, where leakage ratio is as low as 10%. So that basically indicates that there is scope within those businesses to actually shift the stock. So the rationale is, if some of those businesses are already procuring from the local economy, then surely the ones who are not procuring from the local economy can be incentivized to do that. One of the things that we found with respect to the festival is that the marketing efforts were basically highlighted by most of the respondents as being relatively weak. And I think that this also partly explains the high number of local tourists, visitors to the province, because I think most of it was confined to community radio, community newspapers and so forth. So a lot of the outside tourists actually headed through word of mouth and so forth. So there is definitely scope to enhance the number of visitors to these festivals. So the other side that I'm going to talk to arose from a project that we did on the socio-economic impact of PWP on AZN. So the central objective here was to assess the impact of PWP on the province with respect to poverty. So we evaluated, I think it's a tourism component in public employment, and we evaluated one of those interventions within the province. And one of the things that we found was that the program did not meet its targets during phase two of the EPWP within the province. There was also evidence of, and this was coming basically from the employers, that there's a mismatch of targeting workers with respect to the needs of the sector. So tourism, being a services-dominated industry, tends to require relatively higher levels of education. And this is related to, people working in the industry are supposed to have a relatively basic level of understanding of the region in which they operate, where sites are available. Historical aspects as well are important. And those are usually basics that people learn about when they're in school. Language proficiency, I think, is a central issue that happens across tourism, whether it be in travel, tourism, hospitality, and so forth. So that's an issue more so with respect to foreign visitors. So one of the things that we found was the tourism intervention under APWP appeared to be relatively effective in pulling people out of poverty. So 84% of the respondents were above the poverty line whilst they were exposed to the tourism sector. And it was relatively one of the strongest of the 16 profile sites. And it also showed significant contribution to income spending and food consumption. However, one of the things that we observed with respect to those within the tourism intervention, these impacts were not sustained after they exited the program. And also with respect to facilitating pathways into the labor market, less than 40% were in employment after they exited. And one of the issues that also arose was the relatively short duration of work that they've been exposed to, and also the fact that the training was not accredited. It was of a short-term duration. And this obviously has an impact on their ability to find jobs after they've left the force. And it's also a distinction that has been raised by educators who make a distinction between the value of long-term training with respect to tourism and the shortcomings of short-term intervention when it comes to tourism. So it comes that it almost creates a half-baked tourism employment. So those are some of the findings from that particular study. So we've also done work on skills training and education, and here the main things in this area are the attitudes towards work and social security in South Africa, life skills, courses, and environment, and I think the previous slide also spoke about the work that we've done with respect to HIV and AIDS in the workplace with respect to programs for the tourism industry. And also a current project that we're looking at is the review of the tourism human resource development strategy skills audit. We also did, with respect to attitudes, there was a study that we did on which attempted to assess the attitude of South African workers towards employment in the hospitality industry. And I'm going to speak to that. And then after that, just give you a brief overview of some of the work that I'm currently doing on the THR. So with respect to attitude of work seekers towards employment in the hospitality industry, I think the core problem arose from the fact that low-skilled South Africans are basically self-selecting away from low-skilled sectors such as hospitality. And there was a recognition that there was a fairly large number of foreign nationals within the particular sector. So the problem there from the public employment perspective, most of the Department of Labor, is one, the desire to protect, or the objective of protecting employment for South Africans. So part of the study was also motivated by trying to understand why low-skilled, someone doesn't have a job, would not seek employment if it was available. So basically, I think the importance of this study is it moves away from some of the economic explanations and moves to more attitudinal factors of trying to understand the issue, and also to understand employer perspectives on the issue. So some of the key findings that emerged were actually quite interesting. Here we used the public employment services database, which had about 500,000 work seekers, and we sampled about 3,000 of them. So one of the things that we found was that, and it's something that doesn't really feature in economic thinking, which is the role of occupational preferences usually drives employment choices. So more often than not, when you look at developmental policies like the NDP, there are very strong assumptions that are built in there with respect to the provision of jobs. So more often than not, if you look at the different scenarios in Chapter 3, public employment, low-skilled sectors are seen as contributing to, to employing them. But one of the things that they do not look at is that potential of people actually having occupational preferences that do not necessarily fall within those sectors. So South African, and one of the things that also arose was that South African work seekers, that most people value job characteristics and here I think the analytical framework that we used was that of good jobs and bad jobs and the characteristics of those jobs. So they value job security, opportunity for advancement and so on. So these were things that these particular work seekers ranked very highly, and I think in most of the cases almost 80-90% prioritize those issues. And then one of the things that you do see is that the hospitality industry does not offer some of these benefits. So that might be explained, that might also explain the reason why people are self-electing. But I think what's also important is that we did an international review, and it seems that some of the dynamics that you're seeing with respect to this self-election are actually international phenomena. And it's an international phenomena in the United Kingdom. And in the Western world, it's largely related to the fact that locals in those countries are not prepared to work some of the long hours that are characteristic of this industry. But one of the other things that we saw is that occupational choices also exhibit a very complex interplay of several factors. And an example of that is when we assess the likelihood of men versus women to accept employment in the sector across certain variables, what we found is women are more likely than men to self-select into occupations and hospitality, as we would expect. At the same time, women are less likely to want to migrate and are also less likely to seek employment that requires them to work over weekends and overtime. And this is obviously related to those maternal responsibilities that they have. So you might find women who are unemployed who have the desire to actually want to work in the hospitality, but because it doesn't meet those conditions with respect to working hours, then we'll definitely suffer less from that potential factor. So one of the things that we then tried to understand was what would explain the kind of conditions that we were seeing within the sector. And one of the things that became very apparent, and it's not just the hospitality sector, it's also your agro-based sectors, is that seasonality, the elements of seasonality, plays a key role. And then there what is happening is there are peak periods where hospitality establishments make money, and then what happens is in the low periods or the off season, there is some kind of income smoothing through wages and even things like the casualization of labor. So even in the agricultural industry, it's more or less the same dynamic. And one of the challenging aspects with respect to how exactly one begins to address this is the imposition of regulations that would enforce things like basic conditions of work, access to better wages, and so forth, have simply driven some of these businesses to simply reducing their core permanent staff because they do not want to carry the burden of people during those low periods of the business. So obviously this has serious implications on the ability of NDP employment targets to be met with respect to low-skilled workers in labor-intense subsectors such as tourism. And I think that's one of the key roles that tourism plays within the NDP is arises from the fact that it's labor-intensive. And what you're seeing is that labor intensity of tourism to some extent might be sort of factors that might actually prevent people from responding to those opportunities because of some of the characteristics of these sectors. And like I alluded to, one of the interesting things that also did was because there was a view that either social grants that might influence people's attitudes to participate or not participate in this sector. So we then assessed the role of socioeconomic status to induce participation. So it was the tendency to self-select away from hospitality was present irrespective of socioeconomic status, which to a large extent pointed to those issues around occupational preferences and the conditions of basic within those sectors. And again, like we have said, that this is largely related. So there was also an emerging research issue, which was does the presence of foreign nationals in these sectors impact on working conditions in this sector? And I think the only evidence that we found that supports that, so this is an emerging area of research, was the case in India, where because India has a whole caste system to it. So in one of these provinces, which was a fairly well-to-do province, there was a substantial inward migration of people who were considered to be from a lower caste province. And what happened was they basically displaced the locals from some of those low-skilled occupations, and then the locals simply migrated to that city. But we don't know to what extent that is happening in South Africa. But certainly the working conditions also deteriorated within those sectors in India. So here it could be the view that, you know, employers can get away without offering certain benefits to foreigners and so forth, which generally leads to an average decline in working conditions in those particular sectors. So one of the current studies that we're looking at in the sectors group is the Tourism and Human Growth Development Strategy, and that's a project that started last year. And with respect to that, the overall purpose of this project is to facilitate a consultative process in development of a new THRD strategy and an implementation plan for 2016 and 2020. So some of the objectives are to review the existing strategy, to review relevant literature on tourism growth development, to understand the HRD environment within tourism. So we've gone through a range of stakeholder engagement. One of those was related to trying to create a new vision for a new strategy. We had our first revisioning workshop early December, and we're going to have a second revisioning workshop next month in March. The process of collecting data, which is the skills audit, that's going to inform the availability or the scarcity of certain skills within the tourism sector is actually kick-started. This is going to run up until the end of April. So once we get the data, because the skills audit is going to be an important component in informing the development of the strategy based on the skills gap and the scarcity that are in the sector. And one of the things that we've also done in terms of trying to respond to some of the issues that are related to the unemployment of graduates within the sector and some of the more qualitative aspects of tourism is that we are running a survey of tourism establishments alongside the skills audit. So right now, once the data has been collected, we're expecting to have the data cleaned and ready for analysis by around about May. And once that is done, we've already finished the literature review, and we are going to be conducting team comment interviews that are also going to run up until the end of April. So once the data has been collected, it's going to be a process of consolidation of those results, and they're also going to be other quantitative forums where there's going to be the validation of data and also the validation of the draft strategy, and then input from those engagements will be considered, and then they will be integrated into the final strategy. And this is looking around about August. After the strategy has come into place, then we will begin the process of developing the implementation plan, and this will run up to the end of September. So by September, there should be a new THRD strategy in South Africa. So some of the key features from the research that we have done with respect to the evidence on evidence-based on tourism is that the evidence base is relatively fragmented, and lots of studies on specific themes but there isn't a unifying body of work that in some cases allows us to respond more meaningful to some of these national priorities. So for us as well, I think this presentation actually gave us an opportunity to bring in, to align some of the work that we've done with something like the NDP, and to actually see where the work that we're doing is contributing with respect to national policies. So there have been fewer attempts to review and synthesize the evidence across some of these studies, and I think this is one of those processes that actually begins to do that. But we also noted that there's very little comparative work across provinces and between South Africa and other countries. And here, I think the main objective is that such comparisons would begin to inform the analytical value of such a research that has been done. And there are a few dedicated research groups that are operating that are doing work on core research studies, but these are largely operating recycled. So I think those are some of the areas from a research perspective going forward that need to be addressed to strengthen a body of evidence that can actually feed into national policies for planning purposes. So some of the positive recommendations and implications. So the ability of arts and cultural festivals to have a large impact on rural economies is, higher for leadership earlier, likely constrained by high leakage from festival revenue. So there's obviously a need to encourage local procurement, as I've already mentioned. And one of the things that we've observed with respect to a number of festivals in South Africa is, especially the week-long festivals, there tends to be a clustering of activities at the beginning of the event. This is not necessarily the case with things like the Cape Town Jazz Festival, which tends to have a whole stream of activities throughout the event. And most of them tend to cluster, certainly with the Brula Festival. The major events happen at the beginning and at the end. So the problem with that is that it probably explains why you're having an average visitor stay of 2 nights or 3 nights. So here the recommendation would be some of the programs that are developed or designed with respect to these festivals should actually encourage the spreading out of those events so that they incentivize people to stay longer within the festival. So with the Marula Festival, which was also an arts and cultural festival, there was also a lot of the respondents alluded to the fact that the cultural component of it was missing from the festival. And what tends to happen at these festivals is there's an over-reliance on local artists who are seen as crowd pullers. But the problem with those local artists is that most of them usually come from outside province. So although they're pulling in crowds, they are also creating a leakage out of the province through the payments that goes to those. So some of those issues need to be addressed. And this could be encouraging local cultural groups to be the main acts with respect to these events. What is also interesting with respect to the Marula Festival was that there were some foreign visitors from Sweden and the United States that we spoke to. And they were largely not, because I think what happens more often than not is with your typical foreign festival tourists, I think most of these are basically searches that they do on the internet to find out if the cultural festival in South Africa they come. They also lamented the fact that the cultural component, which is what they actually seeking, was lacking from the festival. So there's definitely a need to enhance some of those cultural aspects, which could actually attract people who are interested in the culture of a particular local economy. So the impact of self-selecting away from low-skilled hospitality industry and the impact of the short-term duration of public employment with respect to tourism and intervention, this will definitely, we see this as, so this is a very strong policy implications with respect to the ability to meet 11 million job requirements in the NDP. So these are things that would generally dampen the ability of the tourism industry to respond to that. So yeah, I alluded to the issue of greater enforcement within the labor regulations, especially the basic conditions of work. Although it is something that is necessary, it has to be done with an awareness that increasing those regulations might have unintended consequences with respect to the reduction of the permanent workforce and the increase in labor casualization. So one of the things that needs to happen there is, I think, there's work, emerging work that has done that speaks to some of these areas around social contracts, where labor, employers meet and try and come up with some kind of a win-win situation. Let the bare minimum address some of those issues related to the basic conditions. So we also need to better understand the labor conditions and their impact on training with respect to labor market entry and exit for tourism, particularly public employment policies. And I think I'm going to hand over to Emma to just go through the remaining policy recommendations and decisions.
You're saying that there's definitely a gap, a need for more research on the green economy and tourism, and also to look into skills development and education and learning in tourism more. This is also a significant issue in light of sustainable deployment in line with meeting the NDP targets. What we've picked up so far in terms of skills is that there is a need to align qualifications to industry needs, and we are looking into this as part of the strategy that we're busy with, but it has come up as something that is really, as something that's really important. And we should not overlook the importance of vocational education in tourism, because we have seen that many of the old technicons that used to offer, for example, training in the hospitality industry, hotel schools on our part of universities, and those courses need to be converted to degree courses. And we have to ask questions about what is the value and the implications of that for the industry, and also for the ability of people to then find employment in the industry afterwards if it doesn't address the needs in the industry. There are certainly a place for academic courses, and there are a place for vocational courses. I think that is what we want to highlight. So that is definitely something that's really important. And also the issue of upskilling employees, because we do find lots of casual work and students need lots of seasonality, lots of people doing menial labouring tasks, and we have to also bring that think about that in light of creating decent work. And in terms of promotion in the industry, it is a topical issue, because we are seeing a situation where arrivals are starting to stabilise. I think people get also very excited about that, and then it's because of the visa regulations, and it's because of this and the other. But we have to understand that it's a natural curve in tourism destinations, that when a destination was introduced to the international market, like we heard in 1994, we see rapid growth. And that at some stage, it is a natural tendency for that to start stabilizing, and it's possible to start climbing if we are not very active in terms of innovation to keep ensuring that we are competitive as cities, as regions, as a nation in terms of tourism. So yes, there are contributing factors. We're not saying that those things don't play a role, but it is a natural curve of tourism area growth to at some stage starting to stabilize. And then when we see it, we get uncomfortable and we start looking for all sorts of reasons. But we have to understand it within a context. And then innovation in that respect becomes very, very important. How do we sustain competitiveness? So it is argued that competitiveness can enhance long-term economic growth, which impacts on the job creation and local economic potential of tourism.
So that's something that is emerging research, something that we are saying is important. And that innovation in services and tourism as growth sectors in South African economy needs to be recognized that there is innovation in tourism and services, which looks very different from innovation in space science and pharmaceuticals and biotechnology. And then that non-technological type of innovation in services needs recognition and policy support, seeing that it makes up about 70% of our GDP in South Africa, and potentially more depending on which province we are referring to. Then focus on SMEs are very important in terms of meeting important targets in relation to the NDP, and we are seeing that tourism SMEs are often not really well supported, and people really struggle, especially in rural areas or from marginalized communities, to have entry into the market and to be entrepreneurs within the tourism sector. And what can we do? We don't have the answers, but what can we do to make it easier for people to support them to do that? And more efforts are needed to ensure appropriate benefits of tourism, because many of the studies that we have done point to the fact that local people, particularly marginalized communities in rural areas, do not benefit. And what can we do? And there are recommendations, but like Stuart said, there are different studies finding different things in different areas, and we're not really putting these things together. Also something that we need to look at, how do we put together those recommendations? And local sourcing is needed, training is needed, and real opportunities for us. How can that be supported by our policy? All recommendations, something that we are definitely seeing in terms of tourism research, as she has also mentioned, is very much diverse. It's in little pockets all over the show. At university, sometimes a lot of particular people at universities, within the private sector, where people do consultancy work, at places like the HSRC, even in our own organization, it's in little bits here and there. No real effort has been made to pull together the tourism research that has been happening in South Africa over the last 2 to 3 decades. And there's been a lot, but it's all over, and in different disciplines and whatever. And it's not the issue that it's in different disciplines, but it's not in one place. And it's not speaking to industry, it's not speaking to government. Because this is what I've seen from some of the work that I've been involved with. There are, in provinces, examples of forums where government and the industry gets together, but there are no research. There are no academia, there are no people present doing research on tourism. And then when there are discussions between, there's also very little discussion between academia and government with regard to tourism research, and academia and industry with regard to tourism research. And what we are recommending is some centre or platform where we can push to school people together a little bit so that those systemic relationships can be improved. More research funding needed to look at the role of tourism in the green economy. It's not something that has been receiving a lot of attention, I think. It's not in our work, and I don't think really elsewhere in South Africa either. And it certainly has a role to play when you talk about the green economy. So we need incentives also, it comes back to the skills issue, to increase the uptake of youth and graduates in the tourism industry, to address the issues around youth unemployment, to address the issues around graduates not being employed. So we have to ask, does somebody with a BCom degree from the University of Pretoria, what are his or her chances of being absorbed in the industry? And is it the right skills and things like that? So how many of those people are sitting without jobs, or are they being absorbed? So I think those are the type of questions. Those are the type of things that we are working on. More specific initiatives for program benefits in rural and very urban areas. Here, specifically in relation to township areas. And then also tracer studies to map pathways from the public works program into the labour market. It's something that we recommend. And there's a need to evaluate the effectiveness of public sector tourism interventions. So,
think this is it from us. We've said many things. I just want to add that in addition to slides, there is a handout. And I hope you've seen it. It was all of the work that we've done at the HSLC in relation to tourism. Obviously, we haven't had time to talk about all of those studies. Not this, but there's a list. And if anybody is interested in trying to get some of the studies and some of the papers, you can please contact the HSLC in that regard, or contact some of us if you want more details on any of those studies. Something else I'd like to say is that not all of those studies are necessarily done by the HSLC themselves. Some of them are, but often, you know, you will get HSLC staff who collaborate with others, or who are busy with studies at other universities who publish, and then it appears as part of the HSLC research, but it can be research that might have been done elsewhere at another university. So it's very much in collaboration with others, and I just wanted to point that out. And I think that's all for me. I don't know if anybody else from outside still wants to add anything.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nadu, Ms. Nadu and Professor and Dr. Boyson, for the information that you've given to us. Some of us are very interested in listening to the research and results. In fact, what you are saying now is reminding me of me before I was deployed to this committee. It was something strange out there for those who are interested in it, and now you really have brought up quite a lot of information, a lot of ideas, and maybe some homework for us to do. Honourable members' questions of clarity and what I can write. Honourable Trombok? The three of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you for the HSRC for quite a wide-ranging presentation introducing a lot of topics that we haven't yet had part of on this committee. I found part of the presentation equally stimulating and frustrating because when one was intrigued by what was being said, but then one was almost anticipating the next statement which never came. And I guess I think that's part of the problem of having an overview of work rather than the actual work itself. I think it's a good thing to be handed out this list of studies. I think we are required now to do some further reading and try actually contextualize these essential summaries of some of the work that's been done back to the base research. But I might show two specific issues and then a wider range of issues arising from the presentation. The first one is the comments made about the labour regime. It's on the right page. It's my slide 21. And I found this ad, found these particular observations a little bit different to what we've been hearing in Parliament and other instances. So the middle bullet says, it's a policy recommendation which says a greater enforcement of labour relations, for example, the basic conditions of work might increase participation in hospitality. Now, we know that in tourism there is a very, very high failure rate. Many micro tourism enterprises don't last very long. There's a sustainability problem. And I think this is a sector where you're looking at very base of it and a foundation. I'm not really talking about chain hotels or major tourism enterprises, but the small sort of mom-and-pop type B&B. They would be the type of enterprise that would be the most at risk if they had to operate within a labor regime which is fairly restrictive and is very strictly enforced. And one would have thought that the conclusion there is that if ever there was a case for relaxation of labor laws, it would be in those very, very small enterprises, startups, where people otherwise would not take the risk to start a business if they felt that the labor implications down the line if the business failed would financially cripple them. And President Mbeki once mentioned that in his phone address that the need was there to actually look at areas in the economy where labor laws could be rolled back and where they might not be quite so restricted. And then that kind of is implied in the next bullet, because then there's a need for better understanding of labour conditions and impacts of training for labour market entry and exit of tourism on the EPWP. So I'm trying to understand how an area of the economy which would benefit greatly from a relaxation of labour laws, how we can come up with a policy recommendation that they in fact would need to be enforced to increase participation. Because anything to me, the only way you can increase participation is by making it more difficult to change people in businesses that have failed. But then you're never going to get that business started in the first place, because people understand risk. And that seems to be more an area where there is a looser type of arrangement, knowing what the financial risk going forward. So that's the first question on a specific. The second one is on leakages. A lot has been said in this presentation about economic leakages, and it's said in the context of local initiatives, be they festivals or whatever else. But with people from outside come in, and some of the economic benefit, in fact, a high degree of the economic benefits that flow from that particular initiative don't necessarily accrue to the local economy, and the multiplier effect is lower as a result. Now, I think the statement is true, but I'm trying to understand why it's important. Because at the end of the day, we are surely one nation. And if we have a policy intervention which leads to a high multiplier effect, does it really matter which South Africans are benefiting? Isn't it more important that as many South Africans as possible are benefiting? And we shouldn't be restricting our intervention if some of the benefit flows to outside people. Surely we should be saying if we can actually assist more people, it's less important where they come from as opposed to how many people we can assist. I'm not sure why the accent on a rather narrow focus on if it doesn't have a local benefit that's overwhelmingly local as opposed to from people from another province, why that's such a bad thing. And then my general point here is, it goes back to my opening comments about I would have liked to have heard the next statement in the presentation. And that is the overall policy impact of what is now being investigated and researched and presented to us. So there's, apart from the Western Cape innovation in tourism, there is an analysis, a fairly critical analysis about the lack of efficacy in Limpopo as far as government intervention is concerned. But what I don't see is the compared to what. So it's very hard when one reads statement that says this works or that doesn't work, but I can't compare it to what is perhaps considered to be a benchmark or perhaps comparisons to other provinces. And what I would have liked to have seen in this presentation is something more specific, something that says these are the kind of things, the kind of interventions, the kind of policy initiatives that have been adopted. But in terms of the economic impact, these can be considered unsuccessful, and the others can be considered of average impact, and these are the successful ones, based on some kind of economic benchmark that would help the committee understand what are the kind of things we should be doing, measuring it, and comparing that to other initiatives which perhaps are not quite as successful. Without it, get out of the presentation what the alternatives were. So we've had, and I think quite directly so, I'm not disputing any of the research, it's just the question that backs is, and then what? So we've seen a lot of statements about EWP and lack of sustainability of EWP and how the skills that are transferred and income that's generated doesn't necessarily translate into sustainable participation in industry. I think those points are very well made by our presenter. So what I really would like to see is something which is a little bit more specific that says these are the kind of things we should be doing based on the research, because they have a greater and it's measured, to use an adjective like unsuccessful or effective, one really needs to put a number next to it, because adjectives don't really give the full picture. So that we could understand these are the things that actually work and we can quantify it, and that could help us in our deliberations as far as policy selection and micro economic policies concerned. And then the last point really, I think it's all summed up in what I've been trying to say in the very last slide, the very last point, where it says there's a need to evaluate the effectiveness of public sector tourism intervention. And I think That is exactly your point. It is about evaluation, and evaluation requires measurement, and measurement requires comparison of some public sector interventions as opposed to others. And through UJI, I really have found in this particular presentation very helpful because it stimulates our thinking in the committee in a way we haven't been able to do for, I think, 10 or 15 years. I think this is the first time the HSRC has ever appeared before us. Yeah. But it would be really good if they could come back again. And particularly on that last slide, on that very last bullet on that last slide, give us some kind of idea as to what the policy implications are in a quantifiable and measurable way, and some recommendations as to the kind of things that boost employment, by how much, increased job opportunities, economic impact, GDP, local GDP, the whole thing. So there's a more quantifiable analysis which help us in our deliberations select the right policy alternatives. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. There are two things, Chairperson, that I want to just highlight with regards to the skill training and education. One finds it very challenging, the fact that in the field of tourism, there are very few who are out of the skilled work. So the very challenge is that the first of joining high school at high school level and are not brought into the attention of the scholar. If maybe HSRC could maybe, especially on how should then the rural schools be assisted in absorbing the kids or the students, and if so that they could maybe take part fully on what is happening around them. I'm just saying this, Chairperson, look at the way our people are exposed to tourism. You find that a majority of them, they get employed, if lucky enough, they get employed in these tourist areas owned by those who are lucky enough to have the chance of owning them. As they work their general workers, some of them, because they have that legal education up to grade 12, they might get upgraded as they continuously still serve and end up maybe getting a better position or better understanding of what tourism is all about. Secondly, just one thing I wanted to ask, this is a question for just to pose. The contribution of current draft controlling nutrition, understanding that in most game reserves game must die through the effect of drought. That's where mostly we see tourists from other countries flow into for the big five in most cases. What would their view be on that one? And thirdly, I just wanted to just make a comparison, Chairperson, looking at these activities that take place in South Africa at jazz festival and ceremonies like the Reed and others. One finds it most tourists flow into the jazz festival activities as compared to the traditional ceremonies, where actually the poorest of the poor are, who could maybe by selling their handcraft or artwork, excuse me, would benefit out of the disease by the tourists. And maybe what actually should be done by those organizers in order to attract more tourists to these activities, cultural and traditional activities, in order to sort of assist the locals, like some have now built their PMPs in their area where they could accommodate them, the tourism, rather than them going to the chalet in the parks as well as the hotels and being busy in town. Lastly, President, I was tasked by the presenter when he mentioned the issue of the transport and the Amazizi. Chairperson, this one shows what you might have heard some weeks before, that there are activities that are taking place with local organizations in areas where we have tourists flocking into these groups are there, more especially in the where I'll point out from the presentation we had from the current department, but that there are proper structures that are there that are assisting people, but only find that during this presentation, if mention is made of people out there, only avail themselves as local laborers only, simply they don't show up as people who own some of the things there, as well as maybe forming partnerships, because my understanding is that those people are up there who were forcibly removed in this prison, and now they have developed with the land claims or with the kind of land claims that are sitting there, what is it that they are being assisted on, so that they could maybe form sort of conversations or sort of form sort of being a shareholder somehow, because actually the land they were forcibly removed, and now they're only benefiting as labor, as providing that they are certain in the business of
thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the presenters. It was most interesting. I would have expected you to tell us more about the HSRC, where you are situated, on which department you for, what is your mandate, all that. You can't assume that we know all about that. But anyway, it was a very informative one that we should have had very early in this period of Parliament. Chairperson, I will describe my engagement with the presentation on slide 23, your recommendation. When you recommend that support for tourism SMEs is crucial, can you quantify what kind of support? Because I think you did say, so you can say, tell us what kind of support you need. First of all, I want to begin with a question, Chairperson. Does HSRC has a relationship of a connection with SAT. It is an entity of the Department of Tourism. Because if they study tourism trends, do they connect with SAT? And why not? Then, Chairperson, on page 23 also, the all-over recommendations. A bullet 1, 2, 3, 4 from the bottom. There must be incentives to ensure increased uptake of youth and graduates in the tourism industry. Now my husband is the head of academics on a small campus of the Naval University of Technology. And what I found is that students that do tourism, a diploma in tourism, they are not easily uptake in the labor market. And I want to know whether there is a gap between the academic and the reality, the workplace. Why is that? Then, the next bullet. Specific initiatives for enhancing the pro-poor benefits of tourism in rural and peri-urban areas. Can you quantify what sort of initiatives you are referring here to? Because we want to take this further to our department. Thank you, Chairperson.
1/7. On economy and deployment, your main themes are the significance of tourism as a growth sector for provincial economies. Do you find in our constitution, tourism is has a concurrent function? Do you see that concurrent function as an obstacle for the development of provincial tourism? And if it is, how can that obstacle be removed? You have chosen on slide 7 two studies. You have done one in the Western Cape and one in Limpopo. Why did you choose these provinces? Because the Western Cape is one of the provinces most often visited. I would have assumed that you would have focused on provinces such as mine, Northern Cape, because it's not so often visited, and the Eastern Cape, so that we can see what. I'm not criticizing for it, but I want to know why was it easier. And I would request the HSRC that you should look at all 9 provinces as tourism, as the step in where the mining sector is lacking in tech. Slide 11, responsible township tourism. You say, and key findings, there is a perceived demand for township tourism, but the tourism product offering is underdeveloped. Why do you say perceived? Have you got numbers to back that? And if you say there's an underdevelopment, what does the tourist want? And can you link that to economy, to money? Let me say that, to money. And the person, the Honourable Krombok already spoke about the linkages. I don't want to ask any questions on the green economy. I think that you spoke about another of that. Then on slide 15, the impact of the Marula Festival, right? The Marula Festival is in Limpopo. I'd like to know, does demographics of the visitors play out? And how does the demographics of the people that are at the stores, how does it impact on the all over money that is made there? Then there's an interesting thing, and I would like them to elaborate on that, is the attitude of thing that they mentioned. And how do we go about to correct it? And you are so spot on when you say that low paying jobs are mostly engaged by foreigners. Not that we can't have them here. But imagine, if that kind of work, our people could fill that job. And how do you think this thing of seasonality in the tourism industry? How can we overcome that? Because that is also in agriculture. But how can we overcome that thing of seasonality? And that is not in your presentation. The rebrand, do you think, with all the studies you have done, and although it is negatively impacting on us as South Africans, do you think we can
have increasing tourists from overseas. And how should we encourage them in this spirit where we are now in, so that the tourism industry can grow and create more jobs? Then the other thing I want to ask the chairperson, you've done a study on the Marula Festival, of course it's in Lakopo. Have you done a study on the impact of festivals all over? Where this weekend there's Voortfees in Stellenbosch. Later in the month of March, we'll have a Kaka in Ka, both of them in the Western Cape. But other festivals, such as the Makuve, and give us, if it's a year from now, comparative studies and recommendations, what can other provinces do. I'm specifically asking that with regard to the Eastern Cape. We visited and the perception that we have is that things can be better. Then we can, thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you very much. First and foremost, have you ever given this information to the Department of Tourism? Or maybe also, has the Department of Tourism ever invited you to give you this information around tourism-related research that you have done? Because if not, it is important for the committee to actually ask the department to invite you so that they get as much information as they got today. And also where clarity is required, it can also come from that angle as well, because you've done so much research. And the government has done research, maybe on other things. And see that we are a developing country, and tourism is just starting to come up as a sector, and a very important sector for that matter, seeing that it's spoken about quite a lot. There is SONA budget, even some provinces in their state, in their budget speeches, are talking on tourism. So it is becoming quite a force. And also as one of the service centers, economic services center, there is so much that tourism can bring to the country. We feel it is important that the National Department of Tourism, including South African Tourism, which works together with the National Department of Tourism, to actually invite you, because I'm sure you are open to invitations, to give them such reports around tourism, because they come up with various projects, various programs. In fact, we've been told of the incentive program, which is to be used to incentivize various aspects of new programs, such as SMEs, rural, this, rural, that. And I think it might also play a role in this niche tourism, such as boundaries. So, having given us as a committee all this information, I think it's very important for the department, honorable members, I think, to invite HSRC to give it its side of the story, because there is research, but there are some sides of the story which they have to come to put together so that it's possible to push tourism to the upper limit, or to push it as high as possible. You've got such a major role to play, and though we look at you as a human science Reserve Council, but you seem to be having roller skates. You fit everywhere where the human kind. So I think from my side, all the questions that the members have touched on, you've jotted them down. Mine is just to say it's important for the department to invite you, and maybe we
will be inviting you as well as we move along to come and assist us with what new areas that you come up with. But we've just been told that with new technologies seem to do a disfavor on old technologies. Uber is one of them that is said to be, you know, putting a bigger industry at a disadvantage, at the advantage of smaller industries. So do you have anything to say around that one, technologies? We are acutely aware that you really emphasize on innovation. Whichever area and whichever department can come up with innovative ways of thinking to improve the way they function. Thank you. Can you respond to the questions? And you can answer them if it becomes necessary, or you can actually respond to them one by one. For instance, what Honorable Krumbok has said is the economic aspect, the economic level. How, what is it as far as your presentation has been presented? Because tourism is said to be jobs, to improve employment and also to improve the economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much for all the questions, and I think for us as well, they do stimulate the new research question that we're supposed to be exploring. And certainly, as a science council whose mandate is to do public policy that makes a difference, hearing from the policymakers, hearing those questions from the policymakers is very important for us and very critical. Because it allows us to begin to respond more actively to those questions and also to understand the focus areas with respect to where public policy is supposed to be. Now, with respect to the issue of labor conditions and the recommendations in this study, the recommendation basically flows from the analysis that was done. So we were trying to unpack why people would self-select from certain sectors. And one of the things that became immediately obvious was the fact that working conditions in these sectors are below, or rather are characteristic of what are called bad jobs. Certainly not good jobs. We don't have those basic conditions of employment. So when we then asked the respondents with respect to the value that they place on those basic conditions of employment, and even our interaction with employers, and this was particularly, I actually remember one of our field workers, we were interviewing the manager from one of the fast food outlets. She literally broke down and started crying when she was being told the kind of working conditions that people work in. So we were now saying, so the link there is, there's an emphasis and there's a recurrent theme from the respondents with respect to issues around basic conditions. And this is why I think that following from that finding, the obvious is the so what. So the so what in this instance, with respect to a lever that policy can actually pull, I think the direct mechanism is through the regulation and enforcement. So this is why I say, but that has to be tempered with the understanding, as you rightfully put it, that this sector, more so given the fact that almost 90% of this sector, small to medium enterprises, some of them are relatively survivalist, and don't obviously have a negative impact on that. And some of it we're seeing in our work is not necessarily related to tourism. There's an impact evaluation that we're doing on poverty where an organ of state had invested in a poultry project as a co-op. And what happened was the Department of Labor then came and basically insisted that they pay minimum wages. So the co-op was not yet viable, which is, I think, part of the core component argument that you're making. And essentially speaking, the workers started demanding those higher wages, and it became a little bit lax. The chickens died, and the project ended up closing. So what we're saying when we say that there has to be some kind of a social contract and a social pact, it begins to recognize that there are some portions within that particular sector that might need laxity with this. So you're looking at different regimes with respect to legislation. But at the same time, there is invariably the risk of abusing that laxity in regulation. So this is why I think that it's almost like a catch-22, given the fact that this self-election or the attitude towards the called bad jobs. And also this one of the things that we tested, some of the questions that we asked, and it happens in a lot of countries. In the United States, it's black people self-selecting away from some of the sectors, where you now have an increasing role, increasing number of Mexicans working in those. So almost as if those jobs become tagged as being bad. So those are the attitudes and factors that seem to be driving the willingness of people to participate in those sectors. And that becomes very difficult to influence that. And one of the challenges, even for the Department of Labor, when we were doing the research for, was how do you regulate things like personal occupational preferences? How do you regulate, or how do you come up with strategies that begin to alter those attitudes and inform and encourage people to participate in these sectors? And this internationally is something that a lot of countries are grappling with. I think in the United Kingdom, it's a hot potato issue with respect to migration policy. And there's a view that foreigners are crowding out locals, and the very same perspective and views that I have in South Africa. So you would have people, one anecdote was some of these food beverages outlets pay something like £400 per week, but you still see a reluctance of Brits to work in those sectors, and people choosing to get unemployment benefits of about £40 per week. So these are very perplexing issues that relate to some extent to the broader attitude now, sociological issues around the way people view certain areas. So you, even in the construction sector, when you hear people say, you know, these jobs are for my credit bearing, and so on, how do you begin to alter some of those perspectives? So the recommendation definitely is consistent with the finding that working conditions might be creating this, but that recommendation, as you rightly say, and it's something that I mentioned earlier on, can lead to unintended consequences with respect to some of these suburban businesses. So I think it's an area of ongoing research. So with respect to leakage being low, the reason why there's a focus of trying to understand the impact at the local level arises from the fact that there is a certain level of unevenness with respect to economic performance across South Africa. So government already has certain regions that are classified as priority regions, nodal areas where poverty rates are substantially higher, levels of deprivation are substantially higher than anywhere else, the national averages, so to speak, and the former homelands as well, which are characterized by relatively high levels of unemployment. So in South Africa, you tend to have a concentration of economic activity and wealth, which is over 80% happening in one province. So the question then becomes, how do these small economies capture some of that value-added sort of to stimulate economic activity in those areas? And obviously linked to the concentration of economic activities in Gauteng, you then start finding this massive outward migration. And I think inward migration in Gauteng from around 2000 to now has increased by 200%. So the issue there is it places a lot of pressure on those resources which are experiencing inward migration. So the idea of actually saying that the impact has to accrue to the location that is having the festival begins to I think implicit in that is that once economic activities start to thrive in these areas, then it will slow that outward migration of people. But also it will begin to offer people sustainable livelihoods. So the issue with respect to public employment and tourism I think, again, the question that you raised are very important. But I think some of those are definitely emerging areas of work, because here I think tourism ended up being one of the interventions that we focused on. And this was actually the first impact assessment of EPWP, socioeconomic impact assessment of EPWP. So at the time we were designing the project, these were perspectives that we didn't have. So this is the first part in terms of the findings that we have. And one of the things that became very clear was that the understanding of these pathways into the labor market is not well articulated, even from a program logic from EPWP, because program logic tends to emphasize the transfer of benefits, which is the wage and its impact on poverty. And also our engagement with the Department of Public Works, when we started to venture off into the broader areas, they kept on saying that, but we have to contextualize those impacts within the context of the core objectives of EPWP. So one of the things that we've done, we've presented the report to the provincial government, and they were getting findings like the benchmarks that you were talking about. So what we find is that from the performance point of view, tourism was one of the better performing in terms of its impact during participation. And this is bearing in mind that EPWP offers about 100 days of employment. The worst performing is actually the food for work program. So when it came to comparing them, food for work almost had, it's almost the inverse. Tourism had, during intervention, 85% were above the poverty line. And here, this is the food poverty line, the FSA food poverty line, which is about 443 rand per capita. With respect to food for work, it's actually at 85% were below the poverty line. And there are certain design dynamics that clearly explain some of those differences that we're seeing with respect to that. And there were also other benchmarks with respect to some of the community-based programs around security, alien species clearing and all of that. In terms of facilitating those pathways into the labor market, I remember the tourism one is about 40% were unemployed, which means that they were able to transition into the labor market. And that's precisely because the skills that are being offered tend to be skills that are being demanded in the market. Whereas when you look at the other interventions that we evaluated, some of the skills that they are transferring to people, and most of these skills are actually not well defined and were not well articulated qualifications. And what we picked up was what people call in skills transfer was simply on the job orientation, because they've never worked in those sectors. So that limited versus tourism, that limited the ability of those interventions of having a bigger impact on facilitating those work transitions. But a lot of the questions that you've raised, I think some of them are definitely, this is why we were saying, one of the recommendations that clearly comes out is how do we begin to actually map out the pathways. So someone is involved in public employment, what happens? So these are tracer studies. And one of the reasons why we haven't had any tracer studies is it's the issues of the relatively longitudinal. So you are catching someone as they get into the program, and then after the program you basically trace the how successful were they in employment and so forth. So there's a bit of a design issue with respect to that, issues of around attrition and so forth, but it's something that we're beginning to do. We might be working on another impact assessment that's related to EPWP, where we have proposed for the need of having tracer studies, so that we begin to understand some of these, why it is that some of these interventions are not transferring the benefits or meeting the objective of enhancing labor market participation. Let me see if there are any others that come to mind. Okay, so with respect to attitudinal factors, I think the question was raised, how do we correct these attitudinal factors in hospitality, and how do we overcome the issues of seasonality? And I think that these, as I alluded to, earlier on. I think these are some of those very complex issues. Even when you look at the finding, and this is one of the things that we try to highlight, that some of the occupational outcomes that we are seeing arise from a complex interplay of issues. So with respect to women, it's the fact that they have certain maternal responsibilities that actually prevent them from taking opportunities in these sectors. The more difficult ones are around these perceptions. I think this is why the study deviated from predominantly economic analysis and then shifted to the whole issue of attitudes. So from a policy perspective, it might be difficult to actually come up with interventions that begin to address that. But I think there's also an important take home, which is that some of the outcomes that we're seeing, we tend to place a very huge importance. For example, you know, the issue of why is it that someone who's unemployed would choose to be voluntarily unemployed. Those were big questions that were being asked. So together with the Department of Home Affairs, they would now say, because part of it, like you rightly said, in agriculture, farmers are coming and they're requesting something like 1,000 work permits for low-skilled labor. So both the Department of Labor and the Department of Home Affairs wanted to understand how then should we be responding to these requests. Is there a problem, and how do we address that problem? If it's a problem that can be addressed, then that has certain implications with respect to the way in which immigration regulations are shaping, specifically with respect to work permits and so forth. So here, one of the things that then arises is, to some extent, it's often seen as a big problem. But once you interface it with some of these attitudinal problems, then you just realize that the boundaries with respect to what policy can do are somewhat limited, because at the end of the day, you can't really force people to work. And it's the very same thing that's happening in the United States, where you simply have people who will not work in certain areas, like nail cuts, cleaning of trailers and all of that stuff. In the UK, it's the same thing. The healthcare industry, a lot of the people in those sectors are actually foreigners, and locals are self-selecting from those sectors. So maybe there has to be a social dialogue that happens, that begins to raise this issue with respect to the impact that they have on the ability to meet some of its employment targets going forward. So it's just something that must be all within the domain of some of the work that the Department of Social Development is doing, because they already have interventions around things like creating awareness around things like child abuse, which are also very difficult for policy to have direct interventions towards. And I think those are the ones that those are present that we could something like that.
Thank you very much for the comments. We are writing things down, and we will certainly think about certain things before. We are trying to respond as best as we can. I just want to say that we have never really looked into tourism research done at the HSRC in detail. It's very much a little bit here and there in different departments. So this is also the first time where we are looking into certain topics. And perhaps we should see this as a start in a conversation, because if you've got particular questions around specific studies or want us to look into research done in the area, we can certainly respond to those requests and give more specific guidelines and recommendations, which I hear that has been missing from this presentation. But we have to give a sort of overview. We were asked to give an overview of what is done. And just sort of to point out what the things that we are looking at, but we can respond in more detail to perhaps questions regarding festivals in South Africa, and then we also need to pull together research done by other institutions and universities. So what I want to say is we can certainly respond in more detail on specific issues by looking into that more, and then come up with more specific recommendations and quantifiable figures. And so I want to, I'm going to respond to some of the things that Mr. Zebukula has said, also Mrs. Adams and the Chair, where I think some of your questions or comments, and perhaps not questions, and we hear them, and we agree that we have issues with participation of African people in the tourism industry.
I'm also hearing the issues about the jazz festival. We don't necessarily have the answers, but I think people in development, in tourism in South Africa have really struggled, and I include government and researchers and people doing developmental projects. It's hardly make sure that people benefit in rural areas from tourism because people come to cities. And the jazz festival is really successful cultural thing, but people want to come to Cape Town, and coming to Cape Town they come to a destination, and there's all sorts of other things to do and to see, and there's a variety on offer. And the question is, how do we bring to something like the redance in a rural area? And then immediately, as a social scientist, I want to say, but there's also some problematic issues there around ethical issues, and how do you involve visitors in sort of rituals that are more for particular cultural settings, and do you want visitors in that settings necessarily? What about the people participating? How do they feel that they're now being, is it something that is for them, cultural significance is now being set up as a show? And also, so not only thinking about the economic benefit, but also trying to think a little bit about the social impact of tourism. So the question really remains, how can we do it? We don't have the answers, but we do need to have a legal conversation about cultural tourism. And also, I think something that is important, that is often not said, in terms of cultural tourism, how do we depict, how do we image black people, you know, in South Africa from a tourism perspective? Is it just people dancing, half-naked people, or do we understand that we've got Africans living in cities and that there's urban culture and there's emerging culture, or do we go back to the view of Africans like they used to live and be 100 years ago? And yes, that still exists in certain areas, but it's not no longer the reality. And is that the only image we want to portray, particularly around ethnic cultures in Africa? And that also becomes the issue of how we market tourism. So these are the questions social scientists are asking, in addition to asking about, and for me it's also, what are the contemporary culture? What are the things that people are doing now that can have, and where are the linkages? And we have to explore those things more, but we do also just have to be a little bit more aware of the social impact and ask ourselves those questions as well. I hope that makes sense. I don't know if I'm always saying things in the best way. Again, we are hearing the issue about the Amazizi and the land plan. There is somebody in our department that focuses, an agrarian economist that focuses on land reform issues. And it is a continuing area of research and discussion in South Africa. I don't know. I don't have answer for that. And perhaps Peter would have been able to say something more about land banks, because that is his area. So yes, we can look into certain issues more. We are hearing your questions, we are hearing your concerns, and we do agree with them. In terms of Mrs. Adams's comments, I just quickly pull something up on my computer, and now I've been locked off again, so just give me a moment, because it's locked off if I don't pay attention to it in 5 minutes, around how to quantify the support for tourism SMEs. And we want to say it's not only about money, because I think often the solution is throwing money at something and we've seen that it doesn't work. Because particularly with SMEs, there's questions around entrepreneurial culture, which is very weak in South Africa. And it, you know, there's studies done by UCT on the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor that tells us that people in South Africa struggle and they don't always have a strong entrepreneurial culture. Why that is, I don't know, but that is something that we are seeing. So how do we enhance the entrepreneurial culture in tourism? How do we also, in support programs, think about problem solving, creative thinking, and general business skills? And then even though we find people coming out of colleges or universities with a degree or a diploma, business related, they still struggle to actually go out and do it. Now, there are programs in tourism like Flight of Tourism Enterprise Program that's doing good work from what I understand, but you know, their funding is an issue. They do,
they are able to do the scope of work, and the impact is small, in perhaps in relation to what the need is. And perhaps that is an area where it has been done, but how can it is something that can be upscaled? Can we have more of that? Can we have, make sure that it's more efficient? So those are the types of support in addition to just giving money to people, and coming back to things like mentorship and understanding of the business environment. It's not only an issue of having a qualification, not only an issue of just giving somebody money. There needs to be things like, needs to be mentorship, people's hands need to be held. And there's always been these mentorship programs in certain sectors in tourism, which I understand has had some successes. So how, I think what we need to do is we need to look at those successes and say, how can we increase the benefit and the impact of those? Perhaps not only looking at people in the whole, you know, in the whole hotel sector, but in other sectors of the tourism industry. In terms of us speaking to SIT, I'm not aware of a conversation like that. I think the research that we do is very different from what they do at SIT, but I do think, and this is what we said very, at the very end with regards to the recommendation, we need to have a platform or a center that brings together research in tourism and that links us up with government and with industry players, and not only from the HSRC, because there are tourism research in South Africa, but they are in different places. And including the universities, particularly the universities. So we are not the authority on tourism research in South Africa, but I don't think anybody is, because everybody is doing a little bit. How do we pull together and really tease out, perhaps by doing comparison of things that have been done, tease out what are the lessons learned in a certain body of work. And that can be done, but we need to make it, we need to sort of create a platform or a center or something like that. In terms of your question about skills, speaking to the workplace, I do think we've got a problem there. I do think the fact that many of the vocational qualifications in tourism, because that has fallen away in many cases, that creates problems. And we do need to have a better understanding by bringing people from the universities, from all sorts of private colleges that offer qualifications, from people, FET colleges that offer educational training in tourism, the universities and the industry together, and to really ask, how can we look at this issue? Because if I think of the University of Pretoria, where I did a BCom degree in tourism, I'm sure they've been doing the same thing for the last 20 years without even asking the question, where are people being employed? And I don't want to put them in a bad light, but that is the impression that they've got something that works and they continue just doing it. And then also, so that there's no conversation, as far as I can see, perhaps there are, then I'll stand to be corrected, but the conversation between industry and the providers of education in tourism in this country. So that is something that has again come out of the policy recommendation. How do we engage in that regard? Then, cross-provincial studies, also something that Mrs. Adams raised. I want to just point out that the research we do is often for a client. So, you know, the tender, the provincial of Limpopo wants something done, we tender, we get the project, we do it. So we don't always select what we want to do. Many of the research done HSRC staff or authors or perhaps studies that they've done at universities in collaboration with other people based on their interests or based on their funding. Because we haven't had we don't have a dedicated center or area or group for tourism research in the HSRC. So it's really just, it's everywhere. Like I can keep saying the same thing, but it is all over the show. And yes, we do agree that we need provincial comparison, and we do see that an analytical value of pulling out what the recommendations are, but we didn't, it was never our focus to do something like that, and we haven't had the chance to do something like that, but it's definitely something that we would want to do and see the value of. Then, in, oh, there were questions on township tourism.
And I think the research output linked to this area of work actually addresses many of the questions, Mrs. Adams, that you have on this, and I can send this to you, the paper, if you give me your details after this, because the township tourism, we've not received them all because we had a sample of visitors, but we haven't spoken to everybody. And also, what a tourist wants, if I quickly go to the paper, they are saying that they are looking for heritage and culture in townships, but when they get there are not sufficient activities. If you get this away to this, they have to be to the museum, which is a wonderful museum, but that's all there is. And if they are, you know, the need for, the demand for activities creates economic opportunities. And they go to one of the restaurants to Villa Cardiff Street, and then they get back on the bus, and they drive around, and then they say, oh, there's a slum area, this is how people live when they live in shacks, and they go off to the hotel back in Sandton. So how do we get people off the buses? How do we get them to engage with local opportunities? How do we create programs and incentives so that those people can pick up those local entrepreneurship opportunities to create another restaurant, activity, attraction, B&B? Because there's been studies by people at UDAI, and that's about township B&Bs and how these they are there, but they are also not very well supported because there's not enough to do within the township area other than just visit one or two places. And people come there with the expectation of cultural and heritage attractions, and they're not seeing that. And because of the demand, there are those economic opportunities, but it's lost for some reason to the locals. I just have some questions here. I think some of the things you said about the need to bring together the research addresses, some of the comments that you have given, that we need to engage with the Department of Tourism with regards to our research. And I'm just trying to make sense of my very cryptic notes. I don't know what I said. Thank you, Zaki. Let me just see. But just...
Okay, just to respond to some of the questions around the WE grant and the issue of unemployed graduates. I think the WE grant, I don't think there's been any study that has attempted to analyze what's going to happen with that grant over an increase. But I think already we can get a sense of whether the increase is going to be substantial or not. And this is largely driven by the fact that although the rand might be weakening, because you have to understand that the rand is weakening because of the slowdown in regions such as China. So the Chinese are basically not buying themselves as they usually do. So the areas, different regions which are weakening, which are contributing to the to weakening that. So our exports are not performing as well as they were performing. So it's almost like a catch-22 for South Africa, that the rand is now ripe for tourists to come to South Africa, but it's weaker simply because they are also experiencing a certain weakness in the economy. With respect to Uber gain, there hasn't been anything that has been done with respect to understanding its impact on traditional industries. But what we do know from an economic perspective, it's something that's called creative destruction, whereby, and that's, in fact, you know that something is an innovation when it changes and alters what we do. So innovations that are incremental, which could be a good example, making taxis that are more fuel efficient and that don't break down. That's incremental. It doesn't alter the fundamental dynamics within the industry. But when you have significant innovation, it is going to be disruptive. And there's going to be a transitional period as people move on to the new innovation. And one of the questions that's being asked is there fear? So it's almost like, because people in the current traditional industry, the taxi industry, feel that they're losing out. Part of the problem is a failure of the taxi industry to actually innovate and adopt similar mechanisms that work in the same manner as Uber. So part of the resistance, and I actually remember this whole process, someone was telling me that they used to work for Telkom, and one of the things that they did was when cell phones started coming in South Africa, they were in fixed lines. They demonstrated, and I'm sure some of you might be aware of that, that happened in the 90s. So people demonstrated. So at that time, there was resistance with respect to making the switch. So what often happens with those resistance is this is where you find role players in the industry changing, and we've seen this happen in smartphones, where you had a dominance of the Nokia and the Sophos. So the resistance to adopt the new technology is what actually causes the negative impact that accrues to that particular sector. So right now within the taxi industry, you're seeing that they, instead of simply adopting, because nothing stops them from coming up with an app that uses the same algorithm as Uber, but that resistance is really what's going to catch them. Because really what's happening with Uber is it's only gaining, they basically are spreading, and a lot of people in the United States, I think 40% of, I'm not sure in which month, 40% of all the business-related travel were being generated by Uber. So that's an area of research that needs to be addressed. With respect to working with NDT, I think we've actually started doing that. We have a MOU with them where we are actually doing the TLRD, and I think some of the research that we're doing is ultimately going to feed into some of the research, the immediate research that we're doing. With respect to the issues of what is happening with unemployed graduates, I think that's another complex area. And then the complexity, which is just one area that complicates employment, is that the complex structure of supply of learner products in the industry. And the sources of supply are basically five sources of supply. So you've got private and public institutions that are trading. And I think your example falls into this category. Then you have institutions that are offering vocational training. Then you also have government programs like EWP. There's a supply that's coming from there. Then you also have internal training processes within these institutions. And one of the things that's not fully understood is to what extent do these internal training programs increase the appetite of employing someone who has been educated elsewhere who might not know. And this is certainly something that you see which is very prominent with the big chains like your Hilton, your Hilton Sons and so forth. They prefer to train the people in-house. But also another difficult aspect of supply that's relatively difficult to measure is foreign supply, the impact of foreign supply on the industry, the impact of the foreign supply on the industry to the competition between those graduates and foreign workers. So these five basically, and the linkage between these five is one of the things that we're saying needs further investigation for us to fully understand how exactly they might be affecting employment outcomes and success rates that we're seeing in the sector.
On that happy note, I'd like to say thank you very much, SHRC, for this information. It was really, really eye-opening, and we think the department has a lot to look into in order to improve tourism. And not only tourism, but employment or job creation, and through the GDP, and the economy as a whole. That's looking for a better rent than what we have today. Thank you very much. We'll keep telling you as individual units. And whatever you'll be sending to Honorable Adam, I think it will make sense if you send it through to the committee secretary so that it's shared by all the members of the committee. But thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Honorable Madam, there's no meeting on Friday. Friday is the question today. Some are giving us honorable members. Monday will be nothing. But next we have was Melanie. She's not here now. And I think you all have got, you are excused. You all have got a letter of invitation from Department of Home Affairs on Tuesday. Those who are free can go, please.
so that we hear what the Minister of Home Affairs is saying. Thank you very much. The committee is adjourned. Thank you. And thank you for participating.